Hello and welcome to the Etonicast. As always, I'm Alex Roy, here with my awesome and brilliant co-host, a real journalist, Kirsten Korosek. Hello, Kirsten.
Hello.
And this week we have an awesome, awesome guest. We have the general manager of the Los Angeles Department of Transportation, Salita Reynolds. Hello, Salita.
Hi, y'all.
It's so great to have you here because it's so rare to have a truth teller who understands transportation and the mobility space talking in public, given the monstrous amount of clickbait and nonsense we see around everything that you work on, I guess, every day.
Indeed, indeed. We'll decide at the end how much of a truth teller and how refreshing it's been. I can also get, you know, a little wonky.
It's okay. Yeah. Jargon is allowed on this. Well, wonky is allowed.
I know Alex will call me on it. I know he will call me on it immediately.
Well, actually, it's the reverse because I look to you for authoritative statements. I I'm in total fear whenever I write anything that you will read it and call me out. So thank you.
So please feel free to call Alex out at any time this. And we should mention that Ed is not here, but he is with us in spirit right now as we record this episode. But he'll be back, I think, next episode. So that's great. Alex, do you want to kick things off today?
I'd love to. Salita, could you describe to us, I guess, what is the scope of your responsibilities as a GM of LADOT, geographically, policy-wise, and how long have you been there? A little background.
I came here in August of 2014. I came from the San Francisco MTA, where I had been running the livable streets or part of the livable streets subdivision, which was responsible for all the bike, ped, traffic calming, school safety implementation projects citywide. And I had managed, before that, I had been a consultant. And before that, I had worked for the city of Oakland. So I have about 20 years of experience. The largest number of people I had managed was about 20. And LADOT has 2,000 employees, including around 600 parking enforcement traffic control officers who direct traffic, write parking tickets, do all kinds of things. We also oversee the adjudication of those parking tickets. So to everyone listening, my apologies if you've ever gotten a parking ticket in Los Angeles. But we also manage and operate 7,500 miles of streets, 37,000 parking meters, and about 18 to 20 million trips every year on LADOT transit. So LADOT actually operates the biggest municipal transit agency in LA, in Los Angeles County. Metro is the county transportation authority, but there are dozens of municipal transit operators. But we are one of 88 cities, and we also have to coordinate with five different public works bureaus, Department of City Planning, Water and Power, Metro, Caltrans, all sorts of other agencies and stakeholders in order to get things done.
Wow. So how many?
I oversee taxis. Sorry.
Oh, and taxis.
I don't want to miss taxis. Taxis and shared mobility. They're all in the Department of Mobility Management. Parking, transit, autonomous vehicles, taxis, and shared mobility, bike share, car share, dockless, scooters, all of that lives under mobility management.
So
there isn't enough time in the day to discuss all these topics.
Yeah, but Kirsten, as a good baseline, I mean, you gave us a good baseline of how many people you manage. But on the user side of things, what sort of numbers are we looking at? And I don't know if you have the data to sort of break out by, you know, everything from bike share down through the line through buses and rail and things like that. But what are we talking every year or even every month in terms of usership that you're all these things you're managing are touching these people's lives?
Well, I would say that probably, I mean, you know, it's like 4 million people in LA and, you know, 12 million people in the region. I think one in every 35 Americans lives in LA, in Los Angeles County. And if you live in Los Angeles County, chances are that sooner or later, you are going to come through the city of Los Angeles, either, you know, on one of the 400 million trips a year that travels on Metro's transit system. And then, you know, those folks get to and from those transit stops in, you know, on our streets, either in a car, in a TNC, by foot, by bike. We have a small, you know, bike share system that just started in downtown that's sort of growing. Those are really small numbers, but I think that really the city is a regional hub. And so it's, I think transportation is this connective tissue that touches everybody in this region. And when you see, you know, people stuck in hours of congestion and LA just hit the 100 and I think it's 104 hour mark in INRIX's rankings of how many hours people spend in traffic. When you spend more than 100 hours in traffic on an annual basis, chances are that that's because you work in Los Angeles because that's where the opportunities are, but your family can't afford to live here. And so you have to have a house that's far away, or because you can't afford to send your kid to private school and you can't afford to live in the neighborhoods that have good public schools, you've had to move really far outside the city. Or this is where your parents' doctor is, and so you have to bring them into the city of LA. So it's that scale in terms of, you know, how many people I think we touch every year.
So I'm not going to ask you how we solve this problem because I think we'd be here for like the next 12 hours. So let's
wait. Which problem though? Which problem?
The
I got 99 problems, Kirsten.
Okay. So let's start with the traffic congestion problem. And one is, it is traffic congestion in LA even something that is solvable? Because there are so many things out of DOT's control, like people having to live outside of the city of LA but commute into work every day.
We're talking about big abstract things right now, big policy questions in about, you know, excellence of public schools or our profound failure to build adequate housing for all of the jobs we've created, or these are really big things. There are also more specific things, though, that I do think are the responsibility of the public and the private sector to lead a conversation around. And one of those is really about how we manage demand. So what we have in the transportation system is a utility, right? It's infrastructure, just like the infrastructure that delivers water or power to your house every day. But we don't think of it in the same way. We don't price it the same way. We don't deliver it the same way. And so we've got this amazing asset, all this concrete and asphalt and, you know, traffic signals and everything else that goes with it that we've built, and there's bottomless demand for it. So one of the reasons why congestion is so difficult to solve is that the minute you free up space in a system, it is immediately consumed with what's called a latent or induced demand, right? And in a thriving city, congestion is absolutely the symptom of a thriving and booming economy and city. You can go to a lot of American cities that have been struggling, and their mayors would tell you that they would love to see congestion because it's a sign of a healthy economy. It's also one of the things that makes transit work. If there isn't congestion and transit becomes less and less time competitive, then people don't use transit, right? So congestion is frustrating. There are absolutely things that we could be doing to manage it better and to nudge people to behave differently. But it's also the sign of a lot of other things that we really like that are very positive.
So, Salita, I mean, what is the metric of success in the management of a complex multimodal, you know, urban transportation system? Is there, like, what cities does or city do you and your peers look at and say, well, they're doing it right?
So I think that London has done some really interesting things around trying to manage congestion. Of course, they have a much more mature and robust set of alternatives for people to take. But they've also experienced this huge boom in the number of people who are able to ride bikes. And so there's been some pretty great footage recently in numbers from London demonstrating that, you know, if you manage demand by pricing it, and if you give people choices, then they will use those choices and they will take advantage of those alternatives. And now London is sort of at the place where they're thinking about other ways to manage their air quality using some of those same mechanisms that were really successful. I also think closer to home that the way that Houston redesigned its bus system almost overnight. And the way that Seattle has been sort of managing and redesigning its transit system and its bike and ped network have been some of the things that are the most exciting to watch.
There's obviously no single vector transportation solution for any one city because humans are multimodal. Are we going to see a spate of cities sign deals, public-private partnerships, where massive amounts of one solution roll in, and then the companies lose their shirts and the cities sour on any solutions? Yeah. Is that, I mean, it seems to me like that's very likely.
So what's interesting to me, and I've been the first person who's been going around and saying, look, these are not mobility companies. They aren't. They're data companies. And what they're gathering and how they're using it, both in the moment and well after, is not well understood by anybody because they have been so fiercely protective and opaque about the data they collect and how they're using it. But I do believe strongly that, you know, for these guys, it is a volume game. It is about who has the largest number of poorly made, you know, mobility devices on the city streets at any given time, and then how much data they can harvest, you know, both through the app that you're running and through everything else that's running in the background. And we are so not prepared for companies that are building empires on top of those kinds of platforms. But then something really interesting happened. I don't know, a couple of weeks ago, the CEO of Bird Scooters, which has been gotten the brunt of some of the most negative press about the sort of rollout in Los Angeles and in San Francisco, came out with this, I don't know if it was a press release or if it was a letter that they sent out to their fellow companies. And they were asking for these three principles. So one was, we pick up all our crap at the end of every day, which would be amazing. Cause I was like, these guys are not investing even two pennies in operations. Right. But nope, they're saying we're going to clean up all of our devices, all of our things at the end of every day. That was one. The second one was actually engaging in revenue sharing with the city, which fine, we'll see. Right. But the third one was about not adding new things to the fleet until they demonstrate a certain threshold of use of the existing things on the street. So that signaled to me that they might be, I mean, in order to have that kind of agreement, you have to share some data, right?
Do you see that moving forward where companies like, let's say Jump is the example, but where companies in the shared mobility space willingly say that they'll share some data with cities? Like,
I sure hope so. So there's two categories of data, right? There's one that's about safety, which even there, you know, is having a sort of a back and forth with this guy from Newtonomy, which is a, you know, AV company that's been rolling out in Boston.
Yeah, we know Newtonomy, guys.
We know Newtonomy. And it was one of their lawyers, I have to say. So it wasn't one of their owners or one of their, but he was saying, well, California is trying to force us to share safety data. And, you know, if they do that, we're just never going to roll out in California because we don't want to share safety data. That stance, I think, is going to be less permissible, and people and hopefully the public sector will be less comfortable or less willing to allow that. But then there's this other category of data, which is about planning and about how to get information so that we can focus investments. And, you know, if I'm seeing that tons of people are riding dockless bike share and scooters in a particular corridor, well, then I'd like to leverage and get access to those folks so that I can get them to come advocate for better bike facilities in that corridor so that I can focus investment of, you know, better protected bikeways and slower streets where people are using these kinds of things. So there's not a lot of long games being played on that side of the house.
So if mobility is a continuum of, you know, 30 kinds of modes of transportation. And a multi-pass is a single point of payment that allows you to use adjacent modes through an aggregator, all right, which means mobility finally meets something useful. So to the best of your knowledge, how many modes has Uber or anyone attempted to aggregate through by going through LADOT? Are they doing this without talking to you? But because I imagine they would have to.
Oh, yes, 100%. They're not talking to me at all.
Really?
Why would they talk to me?
All right, so
they don't care about this. There's a train.
There's a bus.
They do not consider that part of a mobility network, though.
Well, how's that? What?
I mean, look at their data, right? I mean, they're look at and listen to their sound bites. I mean, they talk about wanting to run. I mean, Dara came out and said he wanted to run the transit system in a city, right? He said, I'd like to just go ahead and they don't want to coordinate. They want to run it. They want to take it over. And when you look at where they are, so, you know, finally, after years of being in operation, millions of trips, building a business on our streets, you know, UC Davis finally came out with this paper that had data from 5 or 6 American cities, including Los Angeles, about who's taking Uber and Lyft and why and where they're going. And they're taking trips off of every other mode except commuter rail, where there's like a slight increase in the number of trips that they're linking to on commuter rail. But their talking points up until then were, you know, Uber and Lyft are friends of public transit. We connect with public transit. We don't want to replace public transit. And that's just nonsense, right? You don't offer $2 rides to get from downtown Los Angeles to Santa Monica unless you are trying to pull people off of the Expo line, which costs $1.75, you know?
So I imagine because of your career path that you believe that there is a public is an obligation of the government has an obligation to provide a transportation network at a reasonable cost serving
Somebody has that responsibility, yes.
And obviously when weather is bad, you know, public bus and transit does not spike in price.
Right. And it doesn't spike on New Year's Eve or on Halloween or near the Abbey in West Hollywood on a Saturday night.
It would seem to me like we would need, especially in cities and states where public-private partnerships yield some parts of the public of network to private companies like Uber, that there needs to be like universal basic mobility, a compact that caps surge pricing for people, especially the working class people who need to rely on these networks.
So I think there's sort of two things that I've been thinking about as it relates to this. One is we didn't in cities, when I say we, I mean cities. So we in cities have not done a good job of setting down the rules of engagement for private mobility services that are going to operate on our streets and need to use our infrastructure in order to make money and grow their businesses. You know, we have sort of these fits and starts around collaboration or investment, but we didn't have a comprehensive set of rules for how we expected people to act when they come into the city of Los Angeles. And we also did not create a mechanism to invest in those services so that I can actually have a say about what the service area is, what the frequency of service is, what the fares are, and that in exchange, I'm getting data and information about who's being served and who's not being served, right? We have that in place for taxis. We have it in place for transit. We didn't ever create a way to put real skin in the game with these private mobility companies. So we're now in the process, at least in Los Angeles, of doing both of those things. So we went through an effort to bring about 95 different companies to be pre-qualified to work with us. So procurement in cities is just a gigantic hurdle to collaboration. So instead, we pre-qualify these companies, and almost every major auto manufacturer is on that list, as well as software companies and AI companies, product companies. And we can get under contract with them in a matter of weeks. So we did that. And then at the same time, very first thing that we released to that bench was a scope of work for somebody to come in and set up those ground rules for LADOT to think about itself as a product company. And the product that we're delivering is mobility.
Well, that's very compelling pitch, Mr. Reynolds.
I paused for that all to for the listening audience to take that in to account. You just said
that was a lot. That was a lot. May I keep going, Kirsten?
I mean, why stop you now? It's fine. No, it's fine. No. These are good questions. This is good. Let's keep this going.
So another piece on the extreme end of the mobility continuum that's been discussed is high-speed rail and Hyperloop and the Boring Company, obviously. So rather than ask you your opinion on the merits or feasibility of these projects, perhaps could you explain where this technology, say her Hyperloop or the Boring Company had a functional train or whatever, technically it could work. What legal and regulatory hurdles remain before they could begin construction? Because that's really the only story that matters.
So right now they did in LA City Council last week, a council member who oversees the 5th Council District, which is mostly the West Side and parts of the Valley, passed a motion allowing them a categorical exemption from environmental review to build a 2-mile tunnel underneath the city of LA. So setting aside any of the questions around, you know, survey work and all kinds of other things, if the city council acts on that, then they will have permission to build a tunnel. What they won't have permission to do is to build a system, to build stations, to build any of the sort of grander visions that they have. And that would require a full environmental impact review, which can take years and be open to numerous legal challenges. And then eventually, you know, they would have to do some station area planning and they would have to do planning around individual stations. So, you know, when I think about some of these, let's imagine we're in a future where this thing exists and it's basically an underground series of tunnels that is open to private vehicles and 16 person pods. And also, I guess now people biking and walking, although that particular comment strikes me that maybe Elon Musk has never been on a bike in a tunnel when he made that comment that, you know, people who can't afford cars should be able to be on bikes or on foot in the tunnel. But I'd love to give him a tour of the Second Street Tunnel on a bike in downtown LA. But let's say it's open, right? So what? How does that actually work? You as a driver have to. What do you? Is it like riding Space Mountain at Disneyland, where you get a particular, you show up at the appointed time to go down in the elevator? Because it's just like a freeway system, right? They look at the freeway on and off ramps at any given time in Los Angeles. There's tons of people who are waiting in line. And if In-N-Out Burger has taught us nothing, it's that people will wait in line for a really, really long time for something if they think it's really awesome. And so how is that going to look or feel any different from the freeway system we have now, or, you know, from any sort of not well managed or operated a utility system? So those kinds of questions are where the city, I think, will intervene in a very serious way and will require very long conversations, both from a regulatory but also planning perspective, before the first Tesla gets to be whisked from Brentwood to Hawthorne.
So obviously, you know, people have wanted high-speed rail from LA to San Francisco for as long as I've been alive. And Hyperloop is just another name for high-speed rail, just faster.
Yeah.
So all the same impediments exist for Hyperloop versus high-speed rail, right? Like, there's no magic here.
Right.
So why is Hyperloop getting all this press? Because of the association with Musk again?
I think so. And I think also because, you know, part of the allure is this sense that it can be built faster and cheaper, and while at the same time people have, you know, roundly dismissed high-speed rail as something that will ever happen in our lifetime, and it were not for the champion in Jerry Brown, wouldn't have gotten as far as it has. But it's just like the Boring Company. It's like as soon as you start poking at it, it's like, okay, so it's a giant vacuum, right? So I'm sure that the cars in the vacuum will never, ever break down. And that's awesome. But let's just pretend one day they do. And because you can't have windows or doors in a vacuum, the nearest exit is 200 miles away from wherever this thing breaks down. Like what then? When you start poking at these ideas in how they're going to operate, they fall apart. But the ability that these ideas have to sweep people's imaginations up and to make them feel like there must be some secret magic tech bullet that would get us out of all these icky real world problems with projects is so powerful. And people are so desperate for an answer that they really are willing to just wholesale kind of accept that this came from a genius. And so it must be a genius idea.
How do we get high-speed rail? I mean, how do we, as a region, a country, a state, city, work to actually get something that is better than what we have now?
Well, I think part of it goes back to that question of, you know, my little microcosm about procurement. And if you look at, you know, how long it's taken Boeing and Lockheed to build this a rocket, right? And it's billions of dollars, and there's no thing, right? There's nothing delivered yet. And meanwhile, over here in SpaceX, the rocket is, you know, it's been delivered. And that's because of the way that government manages its contracts versus the way that a product company thinks about and manages its contracts. And I think that until we really break down that silo in the way that we think about how we manage public dollars versus the way that private investment works into products and kind of reconcile those two things, I think you're going to keep on seeing outcomes like this. And the other, you know, challenge is that in a lot of other countries, the finance mechanism is different. So you don't have to go to the public and ask them to tax themselves for a specific project because you're in Denmark and there's a 50% income tax, right? And so, and that money is mostly federalized, and there's a very consolidated top-down federalism sort of approach to using that money and delivering projects. And we don't have that here. So I think for a combination of reasons that have to do with how we procure things and how we fund things, we get these kinds of outcomes. And I do think there are ways that we could do things differently, but they would require a really massive overhaul in the way the public views government. For government to be able to say with public dollars, okay, private sector, I'm going to give you, you know, $1 million and you're going to deliver this thing at a price of $1 million. In exchange, I am not going to bill you by the hour. I am not going to nickel and dime you on every scope item. I'm going to let you sort of figure out how to deliver that. And I think that that's the one of the sort of challenges that we have.
So a lot of people buy into the notion that we'll have at least level 4 vehicles in 5 to 7 years and on the road, and that it's going to be great. They're going to be awesome. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that in order for them to achieve the lofty goals that people, project upon them, that they'll have to have some ubiquity within an area, a geofenced area. Is it even feasible that the electric or HOV lane would become the autonomous lane in any near or midterm scenario and provide some benefit?
So, I guess what I think is that there are actually pretty small parts of the fleet that you'd want to be able to manage in order to make a difference in the way that traffic works and how well it works for people. You know, we have our ATSAC systems. ATSAC stands for Automated Traffic Surveillance and Control, and it was built in order to facilitate the 1984 Olympics, which were considered, you know, everybody in LA looks at with these rose-colored glasses about this period of time when traffic was great and it was awesome. And part of that was because of ATSAC, yes. But the main reason why traffic was so great during the Olympics is that freight deliveries happened in the middle of the night instead of during the day, right? So it was an operational change they made that made a profound positive impact on how easy it was to get around Los Angeles. So I actually think when you're talking about autonomy and about managing fleets and about, you know, trying to make a difference in traffic, thinking and talking about operational changes that might come specifically around goods movement is a really interesting place to start, because they already have a logistics network in place. And there's an opportunity there to manage a relatively small part of the overall fleet of vehicles on the road if they were to become autonomous and be able to deliver things in the middle of the night, for example, and that you would then reserve some of these lanes that would be goods movement lanes or goods or delivery lanes, that you might see some really positive, interesting outcomes in the short term. Now, what you're talking about, which is, you know, do we get the full benefits, these utopian outcomes, do we really get them until we basically say, like, you can't come into this part of the city unless you have a level 4, level 5 autonomous vehicle? I think in a competitive capitalist society like the one we have in the United States, that is a huge lift and probably not reasonable to foresee in the short term. However, I also think that you could absolutely see us get to a place where we have a network of streets in Los Angeles that are optimized for autonomous vehicles and that we price, right? So it's not just the HOV lanes on the freeway that we have smart lanes on or smart freeways, but we actually have smart streets so that if you are alone in your autonomous, insert OEM here, then you pay a ton of money, right? But if you are on the transit, if you're on the bus, you know, or if you are carpooling, you pay a lot less money and you have access to this network. And if you don't have an autonomous vehicle, then, you know, remember earlier when I was talking about like how we might map out the city and use that as a basis to manage and be sort of municipal air traffic control, not just for things in the air, which we haven't even talked about, but for autonomous vehicles on the ground, then you could see that as an extension of ATSAC, right? We have this system, sophisticated network of traffic signals that manage and control traffic. Why wouldn't that system also be able to manage and control, you know, fleets of vehicles eventually, if we can figure out the right mechanism to do that? So I don't actually think that you have to say every car in this neighborhood has to be autonomous for it to work. Maybe we could get away with that if we were another country. But I do think there are other interesting sort of ideas about how we might get there with a little bit of a different, more creative approach to how we do things.
Well, I'm just wondering what, I mean, if you could craft the perfect solution, I mean, what would it be? I mean, how, I don't want to overcomplicate the question. I'm just curious what you would do if you could, you know, snap your fingers and make all these giant shifts occur.
For me, it's really about the things that I get most excited about are the opportunities that we have to reclaim streets as public space. And if autonomy allows me to do that, because the most expensive part of closing any street, like when we have Ciclavia here, which is our big open streets party, 50,000 people show up, they see their city in a new way, they go to neighborhoods they've never been to, they finally get a chance to get out in the street and ride their bikes with their kids and their families. You know, the most expensive part of that or any block party is the cost of closing the street, the high sort of labor cost of actually physically closing a street to vehicles. If you're able to do that with the flip of a switch, because either the vehicles all have Waze or navigation apps in them or they're autonomous, then you could have a Ciclavia every weekend, you know, and over the course of the day, you know, I could have a street that carries maybe some traffic in the morning, but in the afternoon, I can close it and have it become a playground or have it become an outdoor movie theater. The opportunity to sort of manage the streets to open up those opportunities is the thing that I get most excited about. The other question that really troubles me quite a bit is the one we're not talking about, which is what is the human cost of getting to autonomy going to be? It's clear that people will die as a result of our sort of moving towards autonomous vehicles. And are we really willing to accept that outcome to potentially get to a more perfect safety outcome where we actually have nobody dying on streets and where that isn't considered sort of part of the collateral cost of having transportation system? those are the things that I get really excited about. The things that are going to be necessary to do them are actually have very little to do with technology and a lot more to do with political will and organizing and campaigning. Things like, you know, creating a go zone in Los Angeles where you do have to pay if you want to drive by yourself into that zone. But there are layers and layers of robust choices for you, for other ways for you to get around while you're there. And in doing so, you might interact with somebody on a bike. You might get some exercise. You might stop and linger at a store because it's comfortable and enjoyable to be there. These are the things that are the outcomes that I'm most interested in. You know, we brought in the first artist in residence inside a city department to work and focus on Vision Zero, which is our goal to get to zero traffic deaths in the next by 2025. Those kinds of things are the things that I think, you know, yes, we have to prepare for technology. And obviously, we're spending a ton of time thinking about it and trying to evolve as a city. But those are the outcomes that matter, and that if I could snap my fingers, those are the things I would see when I looked out on the streets.
How many traffic deaths are in the city of LA right now?
So on an annual basis, it's around 250 people on city streets alone. About half of those are people walking mostly, but also some people biking. And so there's a, you know, to give you a frame of reference, in San Francisco, the year that I left, that number of pedestrians or, you know, overall was about 22 people. So, you know, we're talking about hundreds of people more people than we lose to gang violence, gang related homicides on an annual basis.
So last week you had a cyclist hit and killed. You had the day after a cyclist hit at the vigil for the prior day's victim. And then I think yesterday you had an older gentleman who was hit and by multiple vehicles, who all of whom took off.
Yeah.
What can you do about this? Like, I mean, I'm all about driver education and, you know, dramatically increasing rollout of ADAS and like near term hardware and software solutions. What can LADOT or you do on a policy level about this?
Well, so it's also about a systems approach to safe streets, right? Instead of...
You saw, that's a very Robert McNamara Rand Corporation statement.
Easy.
Sorry.
Well, but it is, right? We have not done a good job. We've gone through and sort of in cities on a point by point basis, looked at individual crashes and said, what happened and what can we specifically do to solve for this crash? Instead of saying, let's look at 10 or 20 years of data and let's see where the trends are and where we see crashes over and over again. Because obviously on those streets, there's something deeply wrong with the actual fundamental design of the street. For whatever reason, we've designed a street that is too fast for the interaction and interplay of users. I make this joke every once in a while that I would really love it if OSHA would take a look at our transportation system and our streets like a factory, right? You would never allow a person with no safety equipment, totally vulnerable, standing by themselves on a sidewalk, literally 6 feet away from a 45 mile an hour, 2-ton piece of steel, right? That would not be allowed. But somehow we allow it on our streets. And we allow vehicles to go really fast because that's hardwired into our idea about why we have a right to drive a car. And it was at USDOT, and the undersecretary got up and said, the things we care about in transportation are that we want to go as far as we want, as fast as we want, as cheaply as we want. If those are your values that you design for on the street, then what you get is an outcome that looks like this, right? Where speed at all costs and really the inexpensive delivery of goods and services at all costs trump the safety of people who are other people who are using those streets. So when I say systems approach, I mean looking at the design speed of the street and looking at how many people you have walking on that street, and then changing the design of the street so that it matches the speed that would be safe for people who are walking nearby. That is a radical approach to street design that we have not yet really achieved in the U.S. But that we're just starting.
Certainly not in Tempe, Arizona.
Right. That's right.
No.
Well, thank you so much, Salita. We could go on and on. Where can we learn more about your work at LA DOT online?
So LA DOT Vision Zero has a web presence where we have a geo hub. We have all the data that we use to come up with to do our analysis and come up with all of our countermeasures is at visionzero.lacity.org. And then urbanmobilityla.com is where we have our transportation tech strategy and where a lot of our thinking and planning and dreaming about the future, that's where that lives. And of course, LADOT has its own website as well, but mostly people go to that website because they want to know where to pay their parking ticket or where to catch their dash bus, which are both really important things. But some of our other work sort of has its own home online.
Kirsten, what are you working on? Where can we learn about you online?
Well, I just actually wrapped up a story for the Fortune May print edition on self-driving cars and sort of the liability around that, which was interesting. And I just didn't have nearly enough space to really, you know, I had just like too much info. So, so that's coming out. I just recently wrapped that up and got some other things, little irons in the fire, but I can't really talk about it right now. But open, you know, Freedom of Information Act requests are involved. That's all.
I am. I once drove from the I-10 and I-15 interchange to Santa Monica Pier in 26 minutes. I'm looking to do that again as quickly as possible. Salita, do you think it can be done faster? Yes. Just answer yes or no.
No, not legally.
We shall see. I can be reached on all platforms at AlexRoy144, or if you really want to make friends, at Human Driving, because I'm the Human Driving Association. Too much plugging. Thanks a lot, Salita.
All right.